Jeff Daniels. Jeff is an actor, musician, and playwright. He's appeared in more than 70 films, including Speed, Something Wild, and of course, Dumb and Dumber, along with my fellow Canadian, Jim Carrey. He also had the starring role of Will McAvoy in Aaron Sorkin's political drama, The Newsroom. Jeff is equally at home playing dramatic and comical roles. And home for Jeff these days is Chelsea, Michigan. Jeff is combining his many talents for his Audible audio memoir, Alive and Well Enough. His agent called him up a few years ago and told him that he was the only actor who didn't have a podcast. And Jeff said, "That's a problem?" He told his agent that the only way he was going to do this was if he didn't have to call up friends he'd worked with and beg them to be on the podcast. So, Jeff collaborated with his son, musician Ben Daniels, to create his entertaining and inventive audio memoir.
It's the perfect platform for me. I get to do everything that I do. Act, write, perform songs, gig, make up stuff, entertain people. And that it became this kind of one-man musical, this audio adventure that included how I got started and what acting is for me, what songwriting is to me. And it just became this grab bag of everything I do, I can throw into it. And I'm thrilled that people are responding to it.
You founded the Purple Rose Theater Company in your hometown of Chelsea, Michigan in 1991. Why did you want to create your own theater company?
My wife and I had moved back to Michigan. I was in New York for 10 years. The movies had started to happen. And we could kind of live anywhere. It's not like it is now, but it was, I knew that I might be able to pull this living in the Midwest and still being in the movie business thing off. And so in 86, we moved back there. But after a few years, creatively, I was kind of going to sleep. And so I remembered my days at Circle Repertory Company in New York City, off Broadway, where I started. And I wanted to create my version of that, which included living, breathing playwrights, walking around the green room, all rewriting a second act, and actors and designers. And I wanted to see if I could drop a professional theater company that I envisioned acting with kind of a medium close-up film acting style on stage in front of 170 seats. See if I could create that with the people that were still around here. And 32 years later, we're still here.
Yeah, congratulations. That's very impressive. And I think it's safe to say that the Purple Rose's biggest hit was a play that you wrote called Escanaba in the Moonlight. Can you tell us a bit about this piece?
Well, that one put us on the map for sure. By the map, I mean, not just theatergoers, but people that had never been inside a theater before in their lives. Certainly not to see a play or a professional play. I had done Dumb and Dumber. And yeah, we knew 12-year-old boys would flock to it. You know, it would be their Citizen Kane. But when the demographic kind of came in from like 8 to 80, it was like, well, why? How do I get those people into my theater? Theater is always viewed as elitist. And, you know, it's just the great unwashed never bothers to go. And in some cases, shouldn't. I mean, why bother? And I said, how do I reach them? So I came up with an idea to write a play set in the Midwest about five guys in a deer camp in the Upper Peninsula. And then I included a 10-minute flatulence joke that rivaled Mel Brooks and Blazing Saddles. And we had people flocking to the theater. We had groups of 12 all wearing their hunting gear, their orange vests and their hunting licenses pinned to their backs. I mean, it just became like a little Rocky Horror Picture Show thing.
Mm-hmm. You've included an excerpt from Escanaba in the Moonlight in your audiobook memoir, and I was really impressed by the way you were able to perform all three characters and make them each their own.
Be the only buck you see this year, eh?
Pop, you're just jealous because I kicked your butt last year.
You didn't kick my butt.
My 12-pointer to your little 4-point forkhorn? I think that's a butt-kicking in anybody's book. Would you say that's a butt-kicking, Ruben?
That's a butt-kicking. I took a forkhorn and passed up on a 20-pointer because I didn't have a clear shot. That's right. If you can't make a clean kill, don't make a kill at all.
If you ain't gonna pull the trigger, Pop, snap a picture. At least then you'll have something for your scrapbook.
Hey, don't you forget who you're talking to.
Here we go.
I shot the biggest buck anybody sitting in this room.
Remnar, leave him alone, eh?
Oh, when was that, Pop?
November 15th, 1961, back when bucks was thick as mosquitoes. That's right.
Bucks with wings, I'd like to see that, eh?
As a Canadian, I have to congratulate you on your comment that if a country was a small town, they'd call it Canada. My wife, Catherine, has often described our home and native land that way, as a small town. You and your wife, Kathleen, had a very frightening experience one day when you were driving your car in Toronto. Can you tell us about that?
I had been working very hard on my road rage. I was really trying to tamp that down. And I was doing real well, and I got into the city of Toronto off the highway, and we're pulling up to a light, and it's red, and then it turned green, and then this man walks right in front of my car, and I slam on the brakes, and he starts screaming at me, and he's around the side window, and spittle is flying out of his mouth, landing on my windshield or my window, and I just turned to my wife and said, you know, this is a good idea for a song.
Yeah, yeah. And you say in the podcast, you say that this pedestrian was swearing at you in Canadian. Yeah. What does swearing in Canadian sound like?
A joke.
Yeah, yeah. I thought so. That's such a great phrase. I've got to start swearing in Canadian, but not during this interview, of course. But yeah, as you mentioned, you came up this really good song out of this experience. It's called Have a Good Life and Then Die. Could you play a bit for us?
Happy to. Have a good life and die. I hope it hurts so much it makes you cry. I hope it's torturous and slow. I hope you know you're gonna go have a good life and die.
Many listeners know you for your role as Harry Dunn in Dumb and Dumber. It's a classic character. You do this great segment on the podcast called Snack Time with Harry Dunn. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Well, I knew I had to get Dumb and Dumber in there and attract those fans, you know, because there are a lot of them. So I needed to get that into the podcast somehow. And I came up with the idea that Harry Dunn from Dumb and Dumber would have his own interview show. And he was going to call it Snack Time with Harry Dunn, where Harry this week is going to be interviewing the actor who played him in the movie, Jeff Daniels.
So, you're the actor who played me in the movie Dumb and Dumber.
That's right.
Great. Let's let our listeners get to know you. Where are you from?
Michigan.
What state is that in?
Michigan is a state.
Is it near Detroit?
No, Detroit is a city in the state of Michigan.
Really? When did that happen?
It's really fun to listen to, especially you interviewing Harry. It's really cool. You played news anchor Will McAvoy in Aaron Sorkin's HBO series, The Newsroom, and you had the opportunity to deliver an incredible speech that Aaron wrote. How did you prepare yourself to deliver this speech?
Well, initially, the speech that McAvoy gave at Northwestern, and the start of the first episode, was not in the pilot script. It wasn't in the script. It was referred to as something that had happened. And about 10 days before we started shooting the pilot, Aaron came to me and he said, we need to see what happened at Northwestern. You're going to get a speech in a couple days. And I said, okay. And 2 days later, there it was. And he handed me this speech. And at the time, I think I was about 35 years into my career. And he goes, do you think you can learn this in time for shooting? And I remember thinking to myself, I've been waiting 35 years for a writer like this to hand me a speech like that. You just hit it. You memorize it and get it into your head as fast as you can. And then you rep it like a football team would rep the same plays every single day, rep, 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 so that it's so second nature to you. It comes to you as easily as singing the lyrics to Happy Birthday. It's got to be that ingrained. And the only way to do that is repping it. And so for 10 days, that's what I did. And it was a big deal because we didn't have Newsroom. Newsroom was not a show. They were just going to shoot a pilot and then HBO would decide. And it hinged on that speech, I think, because it was in the first 10 minutes of the first episode when America is sitting there with the remote in their hand going, no, I don't think so. And they're off to something else. So we had to grab them. And that speech was meant to grab them. Mm-hmm. And knowing all that, it's the ninth inning, the bases are loaded, and you got to hit a home run. You got to hit a home run. And so I hit it. And we had a show after that.
There is absolutely no evidence to support the statement that we're the greatest country in the world. We're 7th in literacy, 27th in math, 22nd in science, 49th in life expectancy, 178th in infant mortality, 3rd in median household income, number 4 in labor force, and number 4 in exports. We lead the world in only 3 categories: number of incarcerated citizens per capita, number of adults who believe angels are real, and defense spending, where we spend more than the next 26 countries combined, 25 of whom are allies. Now, none of this is the fault of a 20-year-old college student, but you nonetheless are, without a doubt, a member of the worst period, generation period ever, period. So when you ask what makes us the greatest country in the world, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Yosemite?
And if I recall correctly, you nailed it in one take, and it's a fairly long speech, isn't it? About 5 or 6 minutes?
Oh, yeah, I nailed it. Sorkin was beside himself. He was thrilled. I was thrilled. We were all thrilled. And it's a great speech. It's an Aaron Sorkin speech. So, I mean, if you've done the work on it, you get to ride that like Secretariat. Bang. And then they say, cut. And I looked over at Video Village, and they're all crying, partly because we knew we had a show. And then Aaron came over and he said, you're pitching a no-hitter. I'm not going to talk to you, and walked away.
Wow. In 2021, you returned to Broadway to reprise your role as Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. And you were kind enough in your podcast to take us back to that final performance. Can you tell us about the final performance?
Yeah, I had done it for a year, and it was certainly a pinnacle of a long career. It certainly felt like that as I was doing it. Went off and COVID happened. And then coming out of COVID, they wanted to help bring Broadway back. And I kind of wanted not another shot at it, but just to see if what I had missed. So I agreed to come back for 3 months. And with Celia Keenan-Bolger, who played Scout, the two of us came back. It was good. It was good until Omicron hit in December, that virus. And I mean, we were at cast members my last week. They were dropping like flies from COVID. And, you know, I test negative and I get to go on. But we got to that last performance. And I wanted to say something because for me, it really felt like the end of Broadway and all of that. I've got the Purple Rose Theater here in Michigan, and that's my focus theatrically. And I just had a sense that this was goodbye. So I started in and did the speech and thanked Celia for agreeing to come back. And then I was able to get the audio and was able to start the speech, you know, on the podcast and then blend it in with just this one camera audio from the back of the orchestra section at the Schubert Theater. And you hear me giving the speech with the audience. It's a great way to end the first episode.
My hope is that... Well, it's just like the judge says, you know, it's time. And so, but my hope is that one day we will all realize that there's only one race, and that's the human race. I'll leave you with this. And I mean no disrespect to those involved. Up in heaven, God walks up to Gregory Peck and says, I got good news and bad news. God says, the good news is they're doing a remake of To Kill a Mockingbird, but don't worry, it's just a play. And Peck said, what's the bad news? And God said, Atticus Finch is going to be played by one of the co-stars of Dumb and Dumber. And then God said, but don't worry, it'll close in a week.
It's a great speech. And that was great that you tracked down the original audio, because it's a great speech. Jeff Daniels, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Alive and Well Enough. It's a fascinating audio memoir filled with a lot of excellent episodic excursions.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Doug.
Jeff Daniels is an actor, musician, and playwright. He stopped by to talk about his audio memoir, Alive and Well Enough. Find out more about Jeff and his audio memoir at WPR.org/beta.
And certainly if it was up to them, they would not have worked with each other, for sure. It really comes down to the fact that the show was not their idea. They were sort of brought in to host it.
Coming up, film critic Matt Singer joins us to talk about how Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert reinvented film criticism. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.